Good evening and welcome to eBible Fellowship's Bible study in 1 Samuel. Tonight will be study number 72 and we're reading in 1 Samuel chapter 4. I'm going to read from verse 1. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out against the Philistines to battle and pitched beside Ebenezer. And the Philistines pitched in Aphek. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines, and they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. And when the people were come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath Jehovah smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of Jehovah out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh, that they might bring from thence the ark of the covenant of Jehovah of hosts, which dwelleth between the cherubims. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. And when the ark of the covenant of Jehovah came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang again. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the ark of Jehovah was come into the camp. And I'll stop reading there. We've already spent a couple of studies looking at the first couple of verses. And just want to make one small correction where it says about 4,000 men in verse 2. I think I've been saying 4,000 men when referring to it and forgetting to mention the word about. About means not exactly, but God said about 4,000 because he wanted to emphasize 4,000, which if you break it down is 10 times 10 times 40, and that would be 40 times 100. So it is spiritually pointing to the completeness of a test, God's test for Israel. And this particular battle is really different than other battles in the sense that this battle with the Philistines in the year 1068 BC is being used by God to illustrate the end of the church age. Also, it's a prefiguring the judgment that would come on Judah, as God actually warns the Jewish people of the nation of Judah about what's going to happen to them if they continue not hearkening to his word. And he tells them through the prophet Jeremiah that he will make this place, meaning Jerusalem, like Shiloh. And so that Shiloh historically was even a type to the Jewish people of an awful judgment. But more than that, spiritually, it is a spiritual picture of the judgment of God on the churches after having a period of time in which God was with them, just like Samuel was with Eli. God was in the midst of the congregations throughout the church age, but the churches were not faithful. And there came a time, a point in history, in which God had to bring about a day of reckoning, and judgment began at the house of God. And so, too, this battle is typifying the judgment that would come, well, let's see, 1068 B.C. You can travel all the way to 1988 A.D., some 2,800 years over 28, 29, I'm not exactly sure, I didn't count out the years, but it is quite a long way off into the future, and yet God is writing about it perfectly. It is an excellent illustration of what he did when he came against the churches and congregations. All right, let's move on into verse 3, and I just want to comment on the first part of the verse, and then we'll take a closer look. And when the people were come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, Wherefore hath Jehovah smitten us today before the Philistines? And let us fetch the ark of the covenant of Jehovah out of Shiloh unto us. So here they realize they've been beaten back. They realize this should not have been. They are the people of God. They have the greatest source of strength imaginable, and that is the Lord, the Almighty. And God has given Israel many historical examples of what happens when he fights for them. He destroyed whole nations like Egypt, and all sorts of battles have been won by God against great odds. The enemy outnumbered the Israelites, and yet God fought for his people. And so it's very obvious that if Israel goes to battle and the Israelites not only lose, but lose in a major way, like this battle, that something is wrong. And God also has given verses in the Old Testament. We read one before in the book of Deuteronomy that when a people is rebellious, when they are disobedient, then he will give them up into the hands of their enemies. And that's exactly what happened. They were smitten before their enemies. And so the elders of Israel are correctly considering the situation. They're trying to analyze what has happened. And that part is good. But the problem is what they decide to do. Now, we went here before, but I just want to remind us, if we go back to Joshua chapter 7, we have a similar situation, but not as great, really, when the Israelites were in the land of Canaan and they were going from nation to nation, commencing the conquest of the land, and they went to a little city of Ai. Hardly anything compared to cities like Jericho, in the previous chapter, the great city of Jericho, who had tremendous walls, was defeated by the Israelites with an excellent example of how God fights for his people as the walls fell down after they encircled it 13 times. And now they come to a little city and there is no victory, but rather they are beaten back and the Israelites suffer the loss of 36 men. Now let's read the reaction again of Joshua and the elders of his day. It says in verse 6 of Joshua 7, "And Joshua rent his clothes and fell to the earth upon his face before the ark of Jehovah until the eventide, he and the elders of Israel, and put dust upon their heads. And Joshua said, Alas, O Lord Jehovah, wherefore hast thou at all brought this people over Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us? Would to God we had been content and dwelt on the other side Jordan. O Lord, what shall I say when Israel turneth their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and the inhabitants of the land shall hear of it, and shall environ us round and cut off our name from the earth. And what wilt thou do unto thy great name?" So Joshua is not going to proceed. He's not going to just make further plans for battle. He's not going to act as though, well, this is a little thing, that it's insignificant. He realizes the great importance of going to battle when you're going to battle as a representative or as a person on the Lord's side. You need to know. This is the most important thing. You need to know that God is with you. You need to know that the Lord is blessing you, helping you, fighting for you, and fighting against those that are against him. And if you go to battle and the enemy is victorious and the enemy is winning, then there's a serious problem. And it is absolutely necessary to go to God in prayer. So again, Joshua and the elders of Israel are doing the correct thing. They're beseeching the Lord. Now, by the way, before I lose this point, let's consider let's consider this idea that we see the Israelites doing historically as they are beaten back by the enemy. Notice the self-reflection. Notice the wonderment, the trouble of mind. Now consider the New Testament church of our day and the spiritual battle that they profess to fight. And notice how often, how continuous, how thoroughly they are defeated, they are beaten back, they are overcome, they are destroyed by their enemies of secular forces or forces within congregations, just anyone and everyone, it seems, could simply overcome them in battle. They seem to have no might, no strength, and no ability to be victorious in spiritual things any longer. Now, if that were in the days of Joshua and Moses and men like that, they would just collapse and say, "Oh God, oh Lord, what is the problem? Why is it that this is the case with the churches and the congregations? How is it that society has come to view the church in the manner it has? What happened to at least some semblance of respect, some semblance of honor given to God and to those that represent him? How is it that the church has become such a laughingstock and a mockery and a place that nobody takes seriously at all? How has this happened?" Well, do we find leaders in the churches? Do we find elders and pastors and deacons beseeching the Lord and crying out to him? No. They're in such a terrible spiritual condition, they don't even know it anymore. They've been so used to spiritual defeat, they don't even realize it anymore. And they don't understand that the problem isn't developing a greater outreach program. It's not having a better VBS course. It's not anything like that. It's not ministry. The problem is God has left them. God has given them up. He has come out of the midst of the congregations. So basically, they're just men. And they're men who profess to be fighting the Lord's battles. But you cannot fight the Lord's battles without the Lord. And so they're easy targets and they're easy victims in the mock battle, really, between the forces of Satan and the forces of the churches. I think it's sort of similar to what we read in Daniel 11, when the king of the south comes against the king of the north. And it says that the kings of those lands both speak lies at the same table. And that's because there is no representative of God at all, not in the south and not in the north any longer. God is finished with the churches and congregations. He has delivered them up finally and totally once for all at the end of the church age. Well, anyway, let's go back to 1 Samuel 4 and continue reading in verse 3. "Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of Jehovah out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." Now, this is the decision of the elders of Israel. And they're in the location of the battle, and it's been a horrible defeat. About 4,000 Israelite men have been killed, and probably the rest are very frightened, and, you know, there's pressure there. There's occurrences that we don't read about, that God didn't seem fit to inform us of, but they were men, and they were fearful, and they had just suffered a great blow in being beaten back, and the elders of Israel, in a sense, are trying to rally the soldiers, rally the men of Israel, to go back into battle and to fight on. And what do they determine? What do they decide is best? Do we read that they fall upon their faces, that they rent their clothes, they put dust on themselves, and they cry out to God, "Oh, Lord, have mercy. Why is it we were beaten back?" Do we even read that they ask the question of God, that they seek the Lord's face to discover why he was not with them? No, they didn't do any of those things. They just simply gathered together, they huddled, and they put their minds together, and they used their own reasoning, and they figured out a way to beat the Philistines. Let's fetch the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah. Fetch, like you would get any object. Go fetch that for me. And that's exactly how they're viewing the Ark of the Covenant, that holy Ark that represents the very present of the eternal God of the Bible. Of course, God wasn't in the Ark. He cannot be contained by even the whole universe or universe of universes. He is uncontainable. Like that saying goes, you can't put God in a box. Of course, people use that in a wrong way. I know someone's mentioned that to me when I try to say, well, God is only speaking through the Bible and he'll not add or subtract to his word. And then they make that sort of statement. You cannot put God in a box, meaning the Bible. Well, no, I didn't put him there. God did. He's the one who said we're not to add or subtract from his word. And if you do, then he'll add unto you the plagues that are written herein. God's the one who has given divine revelation, and he's the one who has communicated to us through the Bible exclusively, the Bible alone and no other way. He's the one who determined to do it that way, so nobody put God in a box. That's exactly what he wanted to do by giving us the book, the Bible. Well, here the elders who should know better, they're the spiritual leaders of Israel. And they're talking about fetching the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah out of Shiloh unto us. Go fetch it. Let's go get the Ark. Of course, we know why they would want to get the Ark, because the Ark represents the presence of God, the power, the might, the glory, the tremendously divine nature of God. And just look at all the wonders that God has worked in time past, and they thought, let's bring the Ark and have God work some wonders for us. It's very slick. It's very packaged, very much like the gospel today, and it's revolving around biblical themes. That is the Ark of the Covenant. You can't get more holy than that. Just like those in the churches have their slick packaged gospels revolve around the Word of God, the Bible. But you can see the difference as to when Joshua and the elders of his day fall down before the Ark, and when these elders in apostate day, in the days of Eli and his rebellious sons, they determine to go fetch the Ark like someone would fetch an idol. Like they would fetch something made of wood and stone and decked with gold and silver. And let us bring our idol, our God, into the battle, and our God will win victory for us. And that's exactly what they say here at the end of verse 3. I'll read from that point again. Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. Notice the word it. And it, of course, with personal pronouns, the translators have a decision to make. They can use the personal pronoun of he, or if it's feminine, she, or if it's neutral, if it's an object, they can use the word it. And the Ark wasn't a thing. It was just something that God used as a representation of himself and his presence. But It is the way that these leaders are viewing it that is so contrary to the nature of God and the nature of that ark. Remember how holy that ark is, that a holy of holies had to be designed and built. That is, they couldn't just make a temple and put the ark into a holy temple, but they had to make a temple, a holy temple, and then partition off an area of that temple and put curtains enclosing it and call it the Holy of Holies. And inside that Holy of Holies, the ark would be placed. And no one was allowed into the Holy of Holies except one man, the high priest, who was only permitted in once in the year on the Day of Atonement. And when he went into the Holy of Holies, he had to have incense burning, so it would be cloudy and murky and smoky. And so even at that time, he could not see very well. And God wanted it that way because it was typifying his presence, his tremendously great glory, and his awful holiness, meaning awful in the sense that it's beyond anything that man can bear. He is supremely holy. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. Now read 1 Samuel 4, verse 3, and look at the language of the elders of Israel, and it's no wonder that the wrath of God was upon them, as they just say, let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant. Let's bring that thing. Let's bring it here to save us out of the hand of our enemies. That is, let us use the Ark to bring about our deliverance. And that's an important word, save us. That's a very Christian word. That's a word you'll find in every church. They always talk about God saving you. And how does God save you? That's, of course, the big question. And it was all throughout time, and especially during the church age, and especially during the latter rain. Now we know God has completed his plan of salvation, but it's still an important question. How does God save? Can people just fetch God? Can they say, God, I want to get saved, so you come now. You come and save me. You come and deliver me. It's time. Things aren't looking too good in my life, so I am at that point where I demand, really, that you come at this point and you deliver me from all of my sins and you get me into heaven. That's the nature of the gospel of the church world today. Every church says, here's what you can do, here's the work, here's the way that you get yourself saved. And you make a decision. You choose. You decide that today is the day you want to be saved, and you just fetch God right to you, and God will save you. Well, did that work for the Israelites when they had the brilliant idea to go fetch the Ark of the Lord to deliver them? It didn't work too well. We'll see as we continue reading on. God doesn't work that way. That's why he doesn't respond to commands. He doesn't respond to orders. You know, he's God, not man, not any of us. We're not God. He's the Almighty. He's the one who says who he will save and who he will not save. As he said to Moses, I will have mercy upon whom I will have mercy. Remember in the book of 2 Kings, in the days of Elisha, in 2 Kings chapter 1, when the king of Israel sent a captain and his 50 to the prophet of the Lord and made a demand. It says in 2 Kings 1, in verse 9, then the king sent unto him a captain of 50 with his 50, and he went up to him And behold, he sat on the top of a hill, and he spake unto him, Thou man of God, the king has said, Come down. Well, he's the king after all. Certainly he can give orders. He can give a command to the man of God. Well, that works fine in the political arena, in all that is under the realm of that king. But God is above all kings. He is King of kings and Lord of lords. And it says in verse 10, And Elijah answered and said to the captain of 50, If I be a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And there came down fire from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Again also he sent unto him another captain of 50 with his 50. And he answered and said unto him, O man of God, thus hath the king said, Come down quickly. A second captain in his 50, following the same mannerism as the first captain. He didn't learn anything when maybe he passed the burnt remains of the 51 men on the ground. And what happens? In verse 12, And Elijah answered and said unto them, If I be a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. And he sent again a captain of the third 50 with his 50. And the third captain of 50 went up and came and fell on his knees before Elijah and besought him and said unto him, O man of God, I pray thee, let my life and the life of these 50 thy servants be precious in thy sight. Behold, there came fire down from heaven and burned up the other two captains of the former 50s with their 50s. Therefore, let my life now be precious in thy sight. You see, that's the way we go to God. We don't make any demands. We don't make any claims. We certainly don't order him around and determine, well, now today you're going to save me because I accept you. No, that's just supreme arrogance. Nothing but pridefulness. And men lift themselves up to lofty perches, spiritually speaking, and God says, I will bring you down. And he's done that in the day of judgment. But no, we go as the third captain in his 50, humbly recognizing that God is the one who gives the orders. He's the one who determines things. And that's something the Israelites did not do, did not recognize. As they said, let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant. Well, we'll pick up our study in the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 4, next time.